On her 38th birthday, the family of Maura Murray has launched a new website hoping it will lead to answers in her disappearance. The Murray family says the new website is a tribute to Maura and a resource for the public to keep her memory alive and play an instrumental role in searching for her.
Somebody in this community is going to have a little piece of information they might not think is important, but then we're going to link that up, put it together in the puzzle, and we're going to solve this case.
The site is MauraMurrayMissing.org.
Through the website, you can also submit tips or any information you might have on Maura Murray's disappearance, and that information will go to her family.
Hi everyone, it's Erin. This is a special bonus episode featuring Bill Rausch. For anyone that doesn't know, Bill was Maura's boyfriend and stationed at Fort Sill in Oklahoma in the Army when Maura disappeared. We recorded this back in January after Julie Murray's interview with the captain on True Crime Garage. For anyone who hasn't heard that yet, it's episode 293 and 294, so make sure to check that out. Also, this past Monday, May 4th, on what would have been Maura's 38th birthday, the Murrays launched a new website at MauraMurrayMissing.org. The site is meant to serve as a resource for people who want to learn more about the case and also serves as a tribute to Maura with pictures and quotes from the friends and family that knew her best. Again, the website is MauraMurrayMissing.org and you can also find it in the show notes. And here's the short clip from my interview with Bill Rausch. So Julie did a podcast with the captain, and I think it's the first long form she's ever done, long form interview. Mm-hmm. What was your take on it? Good, bad, favorite, least favorite parts?
Right. I don't know. I think the first thing that jumped out at me was, you know, it was really good to hear Julie talk about Maura. She did a pod with you about the new theory, and my favorite part of that, you know, short podcast and episode you did was her talking about Maura and some sort of her personality traits, and that was just really nice. So I think episode one of the captain, my favorite part was her talking about Maura and talking about things that, you know, some of the things I was aware of, other things I'd forgotten, and also it was just
like what?
Well, so the talking about how athletic Julie and Maura both were. And, you know, Maura in particular. So it was actually kind of funny to hear Julie say that Maura was better at some things than Julie, because Julie's like super competitive. And, you know, the captain talked about that. But anybody who knows Julie, like she'll like compete over anything. And I've got a very different perspective. I'm not as competitive. And so, you know, it's like, yeah, Julie, you win. Like, I don't even know what you want to compete against, but like, okay, you win. Can we like move on? No, you still want to compete? Okay, great. So it was kind of cool to be like, oh yeah, Maura was better than this. So that was kind of fun. And also, you know, the free throw competition was really, I'd actually forgotten about that. So that was a cool reminder, because it started to make me remember of, you know, when we play basketball at my parents' house, like the same basketball court that I'd practice on. So that was really fun. And it made me think back to her and I shooting hoops and playing pig and horse with my sister and my brother-in-law. And, you know, and she'd win. And then it made me think about, because Julie talked about playing fast pitch softball. And I actually just told my sister that this morning. I was on the phone with her. And the cool thing about Maura, so the first time I played catch with her, because I played baseball as well. Live in the country. My parents live in the country. And so we're playing catch. Like, I'd played a million times with my dad, my sisters, friends, sort of long way against the back of the house. My sisters were all, I have three older sisters. They were all super sporty, and dad coached them, and not too dissimilar than Fred. You know, my sister Crystal probably, and my oldest sister Heather, were probably the most athletic out of the three. And when you played catch with him, it didn't feel like you were playing catch with a girl. But when you played catch with Mora, it was like playing catch with a boy. So I remember I'm like, oh yeah, I can play. I know athletic girls. Like I grew up with them. And I remember we were playing catch and she's like zipping these balls at me. I'm like, holy cow. Like, you know, my sister doesn't play catch like a girl, but she doesn't play catch like Mora. And so that made me think of that, which was super fun. And also just sort of her giggling as she, you know, did all of these things.
Yeah. I really liked the part about when she talked about distance running and how nobody can really push you to be a distance runner. You have to push yourself.
Right.
And obviously Mora did. One of the things in Terry O'Connell's notes that he had exchanged a bunch of emails with a classmate of Mora's named Erin. She was in the nursing program.
Okay.
And Erin wrote, I know she worked out at the gym. I'm pretty sure she was a runner. There was a paper she wrote for an English class that semester where she talked about running on the treadmill and the guy next to her trying to outdo her and how annoyed she was getting.
And she probably smoked him.
I'm sure.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, so it's not only my favorite part because it's about Mora, but I think for folks interested in Mora and interested in the case, it's really helpful to understand who Mora was because it actually informs everything since, sort of whether it's since she grew up with Julie or met me or transferred from West Point to UMass, it informs all of that. And specifically to the distance running piece, because I used to do some distance running. I hated it. There was no hill too high or distance too great. I mean, Mora not only did it, she'd crush it. And so, you know, if you have that understanding of Mora, right, it explains everything else Julie talked about in that episode. Mm-hmm. And then that made me think of a story where, so Mora always ran outside. She hated treadmills, but, you know, sometimes, you know, especially in New England, you've got to run inside if there's mm-hmm. a business, you know, which to be clear, like she would still run outside in the snow. I remember, I think even the Christmas of 2003, we had like a ton of snow in Ohio and she was there and she still ran like in these yeah. country roads. So like, I'm to be clear, like inclement weather was not a problem, but there was a story once where she was on a treadmill and she broke the treadmill. I don't know. Have you heard that story?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's awesome. It's like, awesome. That's how badass she is. And so.
Was it just like going too fast?
Yeah. She was just like literally like wearing the hell out of this treadmill. She just broke it because she's so fast. I mean, she was like.
I think the fastest you can go on a treadmill too is like 5 minute miles.
I don't know.
12 miles an hour.
Yeah. I mean, no, I usually set mine at like a 4:30 mile. Now, I break the treadmill for different reasons because I'm a big guy. But anyways, no. So, yeah. So, like, it made me think of that story, and which was really cool. And you know, to hear her talk about more for that length of time with the captain and that much detail was just, it was really nice. And, you know, it made me think back to some of my own memories.
So, Julie told the story about how she found out that Mora was missing on the captain's podcast.
Yeah.
I'd never heard that story. She had told me, like, vaguely. I knew that she was in North Carolina at the time. But how did you find out?
Well, so I found out similar to Julie. For me, I was I just finished eating dinner and received a call from Fred. And Fred told me that Mora's car was found on the side of the road in New Hampshire and she was missing. And like Julie, I asked a bunch of questions. Like Julie, I didn't get many answers. Fred told me what he knew, which wasn't much. He was going to New Hampshire. And so I told him, hey man, I'll be there soon. And so, hung up the phone. I immediately went into my commander's office because I have to get permission to leave. He wasn't there. So I spoke with our first sergeant and, you know, for the rest of the night, that was a conversation between my commander, my battery commander, my battalion commander, and I mean, it's pretty uncommon for someone's girlfriend to disappear, right? So it was a pretty unique situation, but that was a big focus for the rest of the night until I was on a flight the next morning. And so the other sort of stream of activity was calling my parents. So I called my mom and dad, their landline, had them each get on the line and told them what had happened, which was Mora's car was found on the side of the road in New Hampshire. We don't know why she was there. She's nowhere to be found. And I'm going to New Hampshire. And they said, got it. They're like, we're going to go out too. And so mom and dad said, we're going to drive east. It's about an 8-hour drive, 9 hours maybe to Connecticut. So I got on my computer looking for flights. Found a flight from Oklahoma City to Hartford the next morning. Booked the flight. asked a buddy, hey man, can you take me to the airport tomorrow morning? No problem. I mean, I was really fortunate. I don't know what Julie's situation was at Bragg, but at Fort Sill, I had a really good support group. Yeah, and so I spent all my time with them, and I packed, you know, got things ready, argued to my command why they needed to ensure that I could leave. Mom was working on a Red Cross message, which is required to leave, something we had some experiences with, because while I was at West Point, there were some deaths in the family. And so Mom knew that process well, call the Red Cross, give them the, you know, the five W's, who, what, when, where, and why. And so by the time I got my command sort of on board and they were going to let me go, reluctantly, Mom's working the Red Cross thing. They're in the car driving east. I got my flight booked. I'm packed. I'm freaking out because I don't know what the hell's happening. And my friends are all telling me, man, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And that's how I found out. And then so the next morning, my buddy drove me north up to Oklahoma City, boarded the plane, and then we went from there. And obviously a lot happened after that. And, you know, that's probably a conversation for another time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So obviously you were sensing that there was a high degree of urgency, but it's not a normal, it's not a typical problem, I would imagine, that people request leave for. So it had to have been a hard thing to explain to your commander that this is urgent.
Right. I may have been the first, certainly with this command team. I mean, the dynamic was, you know, what you described, right? So by the time I finally got a hold of my battery commander, who's a captain, I was a lieutenant, I got a hold of him on the phone. So because I think he'd left work for the day. So by the time I got on the phone with him, he's like, hey man, I was told what was going on, but it doesn't really sound like this rises to the level of emergency leave. And so I just basically had to make my case. And I was like, sir, this is my girlfriend. We are in a very serious relationship. You know, we're just going to spend the rest of our lives together. And she's missing. And then obviously he has a bazillion questions. Like, well, what was she doing in New Hampshire? And where she, you know, I was like, I don't know. Like, she's a missing person. And he was reluctant to approve my leave. Another thing that sort of came up was I think I was at zero. I didn't have any vacation saved up. And so that was a sort of a point of concern from his perspective. Like, hey, you don't have any vacation days. You don't have any leave. And so we're not going to let you just go. Like, you're going to, and I'm like, well, I can go in the hole. And then I have, you know, 4.5 or 5, what, how many more years? I'll work that off. Anyway, so he sort of reluctantly called the battalion commander, who was a colonel, and he kind of made his reluctant pitch. And then he called me back and said, hey man, the colonel's not going to approve your leave. And I said, hey sir, can I get the colonel's number? Cause I'm going to call the colonel. And so he gave his number. I called the colonel. I said, hey sir, Lieutenant Roush, you know, tracking that you're not going to, you know, approve my leave. Like, I cannot, you know, emphasize enough how important it is that I get to New Hampshire. And so I shared some things that he wasn't really aware of, like the seriousness of the relationship, the fact that I was going to be able to work out of the hole in terms of vacation days and leave, the fact that all my work was covered, like there's no issue with me being gone. Like, I literally like laid it all out, like, this is why. And he still didn't, he was like, this is not a emergency leave, man. And I finally just made the point to him. I'm like, listen, sir, like, if your wife went missing and didn't come home from work tonight, would you have to explain to the general you need time off to go find her? Or would the general just be like, oh, colonel, go find your wife? Like, that's what this situation is. You know, then we ended the phone call. He said he had to check into some stuff, and he called the battery commander back. They had a conversation, and then he called me back and was, you know, basically like, hey, you know, how much time you need. And, you know, I didn't get my leave approved until pretty late that night. And then I had to go sign out. And so I had to drive back on base to sign out. That was really late that evening because I'd finally gotten the approval. So I had to go in and sign the logbook. And it was a pretty difficult situation, obviously. And, I was pretty upset and frustrated that it wasn't easier. But I mean, frankly, it was a preview of things to come, because even once we got up to New Hampshire, I mean, there were hurdles after hurdles. And, but, you know, that's how I found out. And, you know, nothing prepares you for getting a call like that. It's just, it, you know, Julie said it with the captain. It just doesn't make sense.
Right.
It's so strange. You don't even know where to start, you know, but.
So a lot of people have mentioned the fact that you weren't terribly involved in the Maura Murray community for a lot of years, mm-hmm. but have become a little bit more vocal in the past, I don't know, year and a half or so.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I'm happy to talk about why I've processed Mora's disappearance the way I have, and why there have been times I've been silent or more vocal. Mm-hmm. I mean, the long story sort of short is, anybody who's ever experienced trauma knows that, like, we all process it differently. And I think for me, when I left New Hampshire, I remember vividly the last day I was there, and I flew back to Fort Sill. And, you know, the idea that I would go back has always sort of, you know, been something I've thought about.
So you haven't been back to New Hampshire?
No.
I know that you have a lot going on at the moment, but do you plan to become involved with the Mora Murray community at all in the future?
Yeah. Well, I've had a lot of conversations behind the scenes with folks who, from the Oxygen channel special to other initiatives. And a couple of years ago, I started to talk to Fred on the phone again, more than I had in a while. Then I started to talk to Julie again. And it just became more and more apparent that Mora as a person had sort of morphed into this fictional character.
Right.
And so for me, I think I'm at Fred and Julie's disposal. Always have been, always will be. I'm here to support them. So I think for me, for a little while now, I've been, you know, reading old letters, looking at old photographs, writing, and sort of really just focusing on Mora from the perspective of, you know, 16 years on. So for me, my intent is to become more involved in a supportive role for Julie and Fred, because I agree with Julie and Fred that there's a lot of noise. And if we could maybe get rid of some of the noise, it might help us find Mora. And one of the things Julie said to me recently, she was like, we're going to find her, you know, we're going to find her. And so I'm at a point in my life where I'm ready to be more public and more voiceful. I want to hold whomever's responsible accountable. So I think from my perspective, you know, I've been putting in the work to really not just tell my story, but to tell Mora's story. So that's where I'm at.